AM 950, Matt McNeil. Hello, members. That's right. It is another Best of Revisit interview for you. Matt McNeil here. Thank you once again for being a member of AM 950. We do appreciate it. You're helping to preserve progressive radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul through the election cycle. And we do need it because right now the Republicans are definitely trying to shut down any voices they don't like. So thank you very much for sponsoring. If you'd like to sponsor, go to am950radio.com. Click on the membership page. You can either make a one-time donation or a regular monthly donation. We do appreciate that very much. I want to bring up the best of interview we're doing today, The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota from 1860 to 1876. This is from William Green. This is a fascinating book. I remember when we had him on, it was December of 2018. And we talked about this book. The way this book resonated, I have this as one of those books I have next to my desk at home. I often go back and look at it. And the reason why is because of the historical significance of the failure of this country in the years after the Civil War. And that the coddling of the South, the coddling of the Confederacy, the white Americans who basically said, well, we fought the war, we won, so we don't have to do anything else for you, and turning their back on the African-American population. How that is, that led to the Jim Crow laws, which led to the romanticizing of the Confederacy, whether you look at, the movies like The General with Buster Keaton or Gone with the Wind, where the Confederacy is this misunderstood bunch of Southerners. No, they were a bunch of white people who wanted to keep slaves, and they basically used racism to get poor Southern whites to fight against the African Americans because they insisted that if they become free, then there goes your house, there goes your wife, there goes your kids, they're going to take them all. And so that's when you look at the Confederate flag, that's what you should see. You should see poor whites who basically that their racism overrode their common sense. Because the common sense should have said, wait a minute here. So you're going to have to pay me more money because you're not going to have slaves. So you're going to pay everyone's going to have to get a paycheck as opposed to you getting people to work for free for you. Oh, okay. That sounds actually good for everyone. It was the fear of the black man, which led to the Civil War and then the hostilities and the anger afterwards. And it's a shame that Lincoln was assassinated because we sure did need Lincoln's leadership on this issue after the Civil War. Johnson was a nightmare. Grant was, the Pickett's Charge, which is the famous walk over at Gettysburg and the last day at Gettysburg, the Southern Confederate general. Pickett was a racist pig. At the end of the Civil War, he was just openly assassinating soldiers. He fled to Canada and was hiding there, and Grant let him back in without charges. I know. Children of Lincoln gets into the discussion of why, especially in Minnesota, when the African-American population freed slaves, came back after this, why the white population and how the white population turned their back on them and basically created second-class citizens. We already talked about a few weeks ago, we revisited the interview where we talked about how there was a lot of pro-slavery Minnesotans prior to the Civil War. There were a lot of communities that had Southern whites coming up here with their slaves, and they wanted slavery to be legal in Minnesota. And so it was never so cut and dry here that we're always against it. No, it wasn't really ever that cut and dry. There's a lot of people that were against it, and there's a lot of people that were very pro-United States in Minnesota. But the reality is in the post-Civil War days, the failure of the white population to understand the responsibility that they had and owed the African-American population was catastrophic. And here we are today, 150 plus years later, and we still have a lot of problems, as highlighted by George Floyd. The injustices, the way police forces are used to basically, I mean, the first, I mean, John Oliver on Last Week Tonight talked about the first police forces were basically, you know, police officers who were sent out to round up, you know, runaway slaves. And you think about that, and then you see what happened in South Minneapolis with George Floyd. Yeah, you realize we still have a long, long ways to go because of what happened in those years after the Civil War. A fantastic interview, a wonderful book. Children of Lincoln is an absolutely exceptional book, one of the best ones I've ever read. William Green, here is that interview. Once again, this is from December of 2018. Enjoy, and thank you very much for sponsoring AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. And I'm very excited about talking to my next guest. William Green is professor of history at Augsburg University, author of Degrees of Freedom, The Origins of Civil Rights in Minnesota from 1865 to 1912, and A Peculiar Imbalance, The Rise and Fall of Racial Equality in Minnesota from 1837 to 1869, both published by Minnesota Press. And as well, he's the vice president of the Minnesota Historical Society. His latest book is a very good one, The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1873. Mr. Green, thank you very much. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate that.
One great thing about history writers that are really good at what they write, they find little elements of history that have been forgotten. And as I read your background and the books you've written, you've done a wonderful job of finding the underlying racial issues of the day that people kind of gloss over and they haven't really thought about when it comes to the 1800s in Minnesota. And I think that that's an interesting field to get into. What got you so focused on this level of history and this specific area of history?
Well, it really started a long time ago when I was thinking about college. My folks, I'm from New Orleans, and my parents were active in the civil rights movement, so I was very much aware of names like Hubert Humphrey and Don Frazier and Fritz Mondale, and I was a high school student and I knew what those names were, and yet I was surprised to learn that they were from Minnesota. And you know, as far as I knew, Minnesota was a state that didn't have any African Americans, and so that sort of planted the seed. That wasn't true, but that was what I thought at that time. So that planted the seed for me to understand what is it about Minnesota that would yield that kind of leadership on the national campaign for civil rights. And it kind of began a lifetime of study into the area. When I was in school, in a law school, I had to write a piece, and I found an article about a slave trial that occurred in St. Anthony, which is now Minneapolis, and that seemed really strange to me. And so, in looking at that experience, I found that the story of civil rights history and of race relations in 19th century Minnesota was like peeling away layers of an onion. There were implications upon implications that had not been explored. And I think it's because the dynamic of race relations was so obscure, so minimal, because of the relative absence of large numbers of African Americans, that a lot of historians sort of glossed over it. And so I saw that as my purpose, trying to shed light on that dynamic.
You know, you bring that up, and of course, as going back to your position with the Historical Society, I think the Fort Snelling has done a magnificent job of pointing out that Dred Scott case came from Minnesota. I think as you talk about the layers of these racial issues that were here, I mean, granted, Minnesota was a relatively young state at the beginning of the Civil War, and we didn't really have any major metropolitan areas per se, as you would know on the East Coast. But at the same time, there's a history there that is lost, I think, because I think white America and the white education system sort of, for a long time, put forward this idea, well, and we solved the problem of slavery. done. Right. And of course, that is nowhere near the beginnings of it. And I think it's part of the problem with the systemic racism that exists in the country today is the whitewashing of the racial history of a place like Minnesota, where, you know, we generally don't think of there being, you know, issues on this level, but there is a tremendous history of racial imbalance and racial injustice.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. The challenge that I faced, though, was not just finding that history and understanding the history, but being able to really see the humanity of the people involved, people who did things which in the 21st century seem disagreeable and are disagreeable. You know, the paternalism that many of the white friends of black people had towards black people. But I felt like it was important to really kind of get at the, to respect what they did in terms of fighting a war that freed blacks, campaigning to extend civil rights coverage and protection to African Americans, to understand that commitment, and also understand how in the face of that commitment they could sort of forget that the work still needed to be done to deal with discrimination. I wanted to sort of give them some props while I think, you know, fairly pointing out some of the shortcomings of their view towards race.
And I think you do a very good job, because I think, like I said, a lot of this is lost unless you read a book like yours here.
Thank you so much.
The minority groups in Minnesota at the time of the Civil War, I mean, Native Americans were clearly the largest, what we would consider a minority group at that point. There was the uprising led to the tragedy over by Fort Snelling on Pike Island. You address some of these issues. You talk about some of these issues in the book as well. But as far as the African American population, kind of give us a little bit of a background. How large was it in the state of Minnesota at that point?
It was always a very difficult population to enumerate. There were African Americans who lived here before the territory was established. Some of those African Americans were laborers. Some of them owned even hotels or little cottages for travelers to stay. Some were servants. Of course, there were slaves at Fort Snelling as well. Sylvanus Lowry, who was a legislator and power boss from St. Cloud, had a plantation where he had a few slaves living there. So you had African Americans in all different kinds of categories living in the state, and they're oftentimes not even enumerated by census takers. So you basically learn about them. One was able to learn about them from memoirs and articles and newspapers and letters that were written. They were a pretty invisible population for all intents and purposes.
You mentioned the people that had slaves here. How did that, when, you know, was it one of those cases where, you know, to a point it was like, oh yeah, we're not really a slave state, but we're not going to make a big fuss about this? Or was this something that there was a shunning by the populace, the white populace here, that you know, kind of stopped the owning of slaves in Minnesota?
Well, up until the beginning of the Civil War at Fort Snelling, it was the custom of the War Department to permit officers to bring slaves to the places where they had been deployed. And so we find officers, oftentimes the commandants of the fort, but not exclusively them, officers of the fort who brought slaves from St. Louis. They would purchase slaves in St. Louis, which was a slave market, and they would just bring them up to serve as servants. The Indian agent, Lawrence Tolliver, who had come to Minnesota in the late 20s, 1820s, brought a number of slaves to be sold or rented to anybody who needed them. And that included missionaries as well as officers. So there was a sort of cottage industry, if you will, in slave trading in that regard. At the other hand, other extent, African Americans would jump on a steamboat, for example, especially after the 1840s, to escape the South, and they would just ride a boat, hidden oftentimes on certain boats whose captains were friendly to them, captains who would look the other way. Slaves would hide in the cargo section while the boat headed north to St. Paul. And there were free blacks who were here to receive those fugitive slaves and to help them escape. One famous African-American, well, he wasn't famous, but one noted African-American was a barber in St. Paul named William Taylor and his wife Adeline, who received slaves at Lower Town and spirited them up to his shop. And at certain times where they felt it was safe to move them on, they would send them to another place where a safe house, in effect, later on in Minnesota. So this, African-Americans were both free, and there were slaves who were here, and it seemed to be an arrangement that most white people found peace with, even though this was supposed to be free soil. That's the thing about Minnesota history. Even though the federal law and even though the social custom of Northerners who had come to Minnesota did not like slavery at all, in principle, they learned how to make compromises to their presence. And I'll give one additional example. In the late 1850s, after Dred Scott was decided in 1857, the hotel in St. Anthony was a resort that slaveholders would come to vacation in order to escape the heat in the Deep South, and they'd bring their slaves with them.
The Civil War, as we have, I think, this idea that it resolved a lot, and it didn't. I mean, it ended slavery, and then the amendment ended slavery as a process here in the United States. But at the end of that, it was, I think there was a lot more feeling of promise for the African-American community after the Civil War than actually what materialized. Am I wrong on that?
No, you're absolutely right about that. Absolutely right about that. There was reason for optimism. At last, no longer would blacks be slaves, that they could be free, but they would be citizens. They would be a part of the body politic, and that was inspiring. I mean, before the Civil War, no one really could, or very few people could imagine a society in which slavery would no longer exist, and yet we had that very society. So African Americans, for understandable reasons, and a number of their white friends, for understandable reasons, felt like this was the beginning of a new day. But the problem was that patrons of black opportunity felt that just granting the right to vote would be all that a person needed in order to have full opportunity in this new world. And what they did not understand was the very potent presence of discrimination, that whether a black person had a right to vote didn't mean that an individual would be compelled to sell land to a black person if the black person had money to purchase it. A black person who had the ballot in his hand would not be guaranteed an opportunity to develop a skill, you know, to be an apprentice, to purchase a home anywhere that they wanted if they had the capital to do that. And so even though blacks had civil rights, the rights only went so far as political engagement. It didn't deal with equal opportunity. It didn't deal with certain quality of education or employment or housing or even public accommodations, being able to be served at many of the restaurants and hotels in the cities. So it was limited. It was limited.
Your book focuses on a few people here that they tried. And I mean, it goes back to what you were saying, what made you fascinated about Minnesota, is that there definitely seemed to be an element of fighting racial injustice in Minnesota.
Absolutely.
But there was also, and this was, you know, common everywhere, I think, in the United States, there was a post-Civil War pushback by, you know, angry whites, you know, and racists who basically were terrified of, okay, we've given you your freedom, but let's not get carried away sort of mentality. There were people in Minnesota that were fighting for equal rights, correct?
That's correct. That's correct. There were, but it was a balancing act that policymakers and patrons had to negotiate. We had a huge infusion of unskilled laborers moving into the region after the Civil War, and the sensibility of the postbellum years that white people had towards blacks was that black people, by virtue of just being alive, was a threat to employment and opportunity for themselves. And so you began to see an anti-black sensibility deepen in the North. So even though, you know, the North did not support formally the kind of white supremacy that we see that occurred in the South under the banner of the Klan, the Ku Klux Klan, you still saw segregation in the North, and you still saw a reluctance to invite African Americans to the community because of the fear that black people would take jobs away. And also the concern of blacks intermarrying with white people. That was a real concern for people in the North. So that's why I would call it a degree of freedom. Black people had freedom, but within limits.
In the South, and I've lived in the South a few times, and down there back at that point, if you were perceived as a white person, in many cases, not universally, but in many cases, if you were perceived as a white person who was trying to help the African Americans get a leg up, that trying to equal the playing field, that you were yourself a target, and it was a target. I mean, you were considered an enemy, and in some cases, by some of the elements down there, even a more worse enemy than the African Americans getting their freedom for them. But in
that's absolutely correct. Yeah,
in Minnesota, I mean, I never got the impression it was that bad. I've had a lot of people who have talked about the fact that there is definitely a racism in Minnesota. It's just much more subtle. Did this attempts to basically equal the playing field when you talk about the people that were, it was kind of a balancing act, was the threat very tangible, like in the South, or was it more just a shunning?
No, I think it was possible. Well, it was possible for whites to express support for black rights during the 1870s and 80s. It was possible to do that. And if they were middle class, the people who were inclined to shun them were of a different class and therefore living in a different world. The working class white community lived in the parallel universe from the world of the white middle class. So the white middle class who would be sympathetic to the rights of black people would not necessarily face the shunning. What we saw, what I found at least, was a disinclination to, well, first of all, believe that that all that should be done had been done. In fact, there's a phrase that one of my subjects uses. We've done all that. We've done our part, and now the rest is up to you. So there is a real belief that once the shackles of slavery had ended, had been removed, then it was left to blacks to kind of take it on their own, and that was very much in keeping with the sensibility of the times. Rugged individualism, Horatio Algerism, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You don't need the artificial supports of government or people to kind of take care. If you can't stand up for yourself, then perhaps you deserve to fail. That was the sensibility that prevailed even among the friends of black people. And it wasn't just geared towards blacks. It was about how one looked at society. See, that's the thing about this book, and that's the thing about talking about race in post-war Minnesota in particular. The policies that hurt African Americans, or the attitudes that fail to really go further in providing more opportunities for African Americans, was not anti-black per se as much as it was anti creating artificial support. I mean, people really believed in social Darwinism and the survival of the fittest. And it's one reason why farmers, for example, were denigrated, and laboring men and women were denigrated, and the poor as a whole were denigrated. And blacks were sort of caught in the midst of all of that. To make it even more complicated, even though black people weren't achieving, generally speaking, experiencing the full opportunity that they expected and deserved to have, there was a sense of blacks being, you know, sort of in a different category, that maybe they really can't get as far because of their race and their ethnicity. So you had a sort of perverse sense of paternalism began to set in, where we will take care of your problems, but you have to show gratitude to us. Mm. And that sensibility did not exist with mainstream America towards, or Minnesota towards, laboring, towards the laboring class. And that, of course, exacerbates the tension and the anger and the resentment that working class whites have towards blacks.
I was going to just say this is one of the reasons why I love talking history, is we just went through 20 minutes and it just felt like a drop in the bucket. And if I may step in just really quick, because what you've just described set the stage for everything that's happened in Minneapolis just recently, and I want to get your take on this with a current issue, the Minneapolis 2040 plan, where they got rid of the zoning laws, which was going, once again, as you talked about this system that was set up. Well, we're going to give you an opportunity without really giving them an opportunity. You know, right. You can look at the housing setups and the way that they created this inability of African Americans to move ahead within society, within property laws. You know, it's taken a long time. Do you feel, first of all, that Minneapolis 2040 was a good step? And then do you feel as if, you know, it's going to actually, you know, have its intended consequences?
Well, I think, from what I understand about the policy, I think it's a good attempt, but it doesn't always go far enough. I mean, I think that, you know, if we're talking about creating opportunity across the board, it's multifaceted. It has to be viewed multifaceted. It's almost like you're talking about, you know, housing and things of this nature. I was more involved with education, and in closing the achievement gap, I think we as policymakers were rather myopic in thinking that it could only happen in the classroom, when classrooms had kids for 8 hours. Now, the point that I'm making here, the connection I'm making, is that in improving, providing opportunity, policymakers really have to have the courage, and that's what it takes, to not only create a strategy that deals with housing, employment, education, all at the same time, providing stability and committing to it over a period of time, and being willing to defend the virtue of that type of commitment, because you know, good deed fatigue begins to kick in. Yeah. And that's where, you know, whatever progress one makes begins to slack off and begins to eventually erode. So it's, you know, we will always see, I think, I hope, in this community, efforts to try to deal with one piece of the problem. But if we're just looking at a problem myopically and piecemeal, I think we're forever going to fall short of the ultimate goal. It has to be much more comprehensive, and it has to be a commitment that policymakers will defend against the inevitable reaction to, you know, well, we don't see immediate change, so we're going to shift the resources elsewhere. Mm-hmm. That's something that always happens, it seems like.
We are blessed to have you at the Minnesota Historical Society. Dear God.
Wow. Oh,
we are blessed.
Really kind of you. Thank you.
We are blessed. My
God, what? All right. Anytime you want to come back to my show, I swear. I mean, you've got the invite's open. You need to come back. You want to talk about an issue, I will give you the time. William Green, The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1876. And you, as you just heard, the seeds of what happened back then are leading to the problems we have today. And I mean, they're big problems, but, you know, to understand how to fix them, we have to understand how they began. And this book is a must read. Mr. Green, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure.
It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950.